The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slotkey from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the double issue of Discover Magazine for September and October 2019. We begin today with our cover story, The Science of Gun Violence. Researchers believe public health models hold the key to reducing the damage. How many Americans lost their lives to firearms in 2017? 1.625 million. The number of Americans who have died from gunfire since 1968, more than the accumulated American deaths from all wars since the country's founding more than 200 years ago. These are numbers that everyone agrees on. From here, nearly everything else that can be said about gun violence in the U.S. elicits a partisan response. It doesn't have to be this way. A growing chorus of researchers wants to study gun violence in the U.S. as a public health issue, similar to the way they have tracked automobile or workplace safety for decades. Though limited by largely political obstacles around funding, experts, including epidemiologists, social scientists, and statisticians, say that unbiased, peer-reviewed research is a missing piece of the gun violence discussion. Given the magnitude of the problem, not just in lives lost, but in the consequences for survivors, families, and entire communities, a purely scientific approach may hold the key to making progress towards reducing injuries and fatalities. There's one problem. Where to begin? We just don't know very much, says Andrew Morrill, a behavioral scientist who leads a RAND Corporation initiative called Gun Policy in America. We haven't been investing as a country in research in this area in the same way that we have in motor vehicle accidents, for instance, where for more than 35 years, we have had an entire agency devoted to that, collecting fantastic data. The result has been that motor vehicle accidents are a quarter of what they were at the time that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration was started. A 2017 JAMA study estimates that for every death due to firearms, the U.S. spends about $63 on research into the topic. In contrast, research spending on motor vehicle deaths is about $1,000 per fatality. That disparity is particularly striking because the number of lives lost is similar. From 2008 to 2017, there were 342,439 deaths by firearm and 374,340 motor vehicle deaths. As former Congressman Jay Dickey wrote in 2012, the United States has spent about $240 million a year on traffic safety research, but there has been almost no publicly funded research into firearm injuries. The reason, ironically, has Dickey's name attached to it. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the federal agency responsible for, among other things, researching and reducing injuries and violence, had long studied gun violence. But in 1996, Dickey submitted and helped pass the so-called Dickey Amendment, instructing that none of the funds made available for injury prevention and control at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention may be used to advocate or promote gun control. The language did not ban research. It banned advocacy or promotion for gun control, says Garen Wintemute, a physician and public health researcher who leads the Violence Prevention Research Program at the University of California Davis Medical Center. But everybody saw the writing on the wall, and CDC took itself out of the game. A 2003 provision to a Department of Justice appropriations bill, called the Tyrant Amendment, dealt another blow. It prevented the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives, or ATF, from releasing firearm tracing data, how illegal firearms flow from manufacture to sale to use. Prior to TIRT, such data had been invaluable to academic research, says Morrill. There was very useful scientific research going on looking at how guns flow between U.S. states as a function of how permissive state laws are in terms of gun violence, says Morrell. The ATF also provided research on time to crime, or the length of time between a gun's purchase and its use in a crime. Such information could play a role in determining whether future policies achieve their desired results. The impact of both Dickey and Tyrant has been clear. From 1998 to 2012, the annual number of academic publications on gun violence dropped by 64%. There have been small windows of renewed public funding for research on gun violence, such as a three-year period started during the Obama administration that has since closed, and private donations, such as $2 million that the Kaiser Permanente Health Consortium committed in 2018 to studying the issue, have kept other initiatives afloat. But the limited, disjointed efforts are no substitute for a long-term, concerted focus by a government agency like the CDC in tackling a complex problem. What we do know about gun violence in the U.S., from a purely statistical perspective, may surprise you. Mass shootings make headlines and dominate public discourse, but roughly 60% of firearm deaths in 2017 were suicides. That's 23,854 people who took their own lives with a gun. Most of them are older white men, says Bindu Kalasan, an epidemiologist and data scientist at Boston University School of Medicine. In a 2018 study on suicide in the U.S. due to firearms, Kalasan found that the average American firearm suicide is a married, white male over 50 with physical health issues. In a separate study, Kalasan discovered another demographic group taking the brunt of firearm-related loss of life expectancy, black men under the age of 20 who were dying from homicide. Because black male firearm homicides were much younger on average than white male suicides, the group's life expectancy saw the bigger reduction by more than 4 years. Women, meanwhile, make up around 10% of all U.S. gun deaths, and according to a study of 220 case histories published in the American Journal of Public Health, they are far more likely than men to be killed by an intimate partner. A 2014 review published in the Annals of Internal Medicine found some evidence that women with access to firearms are more likely to be victims of homicides than women without, possibly due to intimate partner violence. Overall, the rate of gun homicide is 25 times higher in the U.S. than in other high-income countries. For comparison, the rate of U.S. homicides due to causes other than firearms is only 2.7 times higher. And data from the FBI shows that handguns are by far the most likely type of firearm to cause a fatality. In 2017, handguns were used in 7,032 of the 7,886 firearm-related homicide deaths where the type of weapon was known. The type of weapon was not recorded in data on roughly 3,100 additional homicides. Perhaps most striking about the gaps in current gun violence data is how little we know about the shootings that don't result in death. If what you care about is state or national level gun deaths, homicides and suicides, we have good data, says Morrell. We don't have good data on firearm injuries, which represents the vast majority of firearm casualties. In fact, the CDC cautions that its own numbers on non-fatal firearm injury are unstable and potentially unreliable due to issues such as insufficient data. Even those imperfect numbers suggest an average of around 130,000 gun injuries per year. And the number of non-fatal gun injuries is merely one unknown in a complex web of gun violence fallout. Individuals and their families may experience physical, psychological, and financial repercussions, and so can the broader community. A neighborhood or city where gun violence is epidemic may also see lower property values, reduced tourism, and less community engagement, says David Hemenway, director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. For the most part, we don't know the details, because they haven't been studied. The key to tackling firearm violence, Hemenway and Pierce say, is taking a science-driven public health approach. The method, as laid out by the CDC, is straightforward. Define problems, identify risk and protective factors, develop and test prevention strategies, and assure their widespread adoption. Hemenway explains the public health model in simpler terms. Make it really hard to get sick and injured, and really easy to get healthy. There's already a long history of using the tools of public health research to reduce injury, perhaps most dramatically with car safety. Since the 1950s, the per-mile fatality rate in the U.S. has fallen by 80%. The reduction is rooted in myriad sources, such as increased seatbelt use, stricter penalties for drunk driving, and new regulations for licensing. The robust data collection overseen by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is particularly important. NHTSA tracks everything from vehicular accidents involving fatalities to recalls and crash test results, all down to the smallest detail. Researchers analyze this data to discover common patterns, while lawmakers use it to measure the effect of legislation. Graduated driver licensing, a multi-stage process for young drivers to become fully licensed, is a classic example. Researchers discovered that 16-year-olds had 10 times the risk of getting into a crash as older drivers. Those accidents happen most often at night and while driving unsupervised with other teens. So states implemented a simple solution. Initially restrict newly licensed young drivers from driving at night or alone with their peers. By 1997, all 50 states had implemented some form of graduated licensing, and results were often dramatic. In Michigan, for example, the crash risk for 16-year-old drivers fell by almost 30%. Such an impressive reduction in deaths, thanks to the public health approach, is not an outlier. For example, in the mid-1960s, more than 11,000 young children were poisoned by baby aspirin each year. Doctors, researchers, and drug manufacturers took a multidisciplinary public health approach, addressing drug flavoring and marketing, parent education, and dosing. The effort culminated in the Poison Prevention Packaging Act of 1970, when the U.S. mandated the medicine be sold in child-resistant packaging. Accidental baby aspirin poisonings of children younger than 5 dropped by an astonishing 70% 3 years after the change. The public health approach can even save lives by analyzing data and identifying injury reductions that come about by happenstance. For instance, before England and Wales shifted utilities from domestic coal gas to natural gas in the 1960s and 70s, an economic decision that by chance eliminated deadly carbon monoxide, inhaling oven fumes was the method of choice for 41% of all suicides in 1963. After the switch, it became nearly impossible. The overall suicide rate in the two countries dropped by 30% and never rebounded. Preventing suicide was an unintended consequence, revealed after the fact through public health data. But it showed what can happen when individuals contemplating the act lose an easy access method. Something similar may be possible when it comes to reducing gun violence. For instance, public health researchers agree that suicide is typically an impulsive act, often aborted before completion, and that the majority of people who survive an initial suicide attempt never make a second try. As shown in England and Wales, when an immediately accessible, highly effective means of suicide is no longer available, the overall suicide rate may drop. In the U.S., the limited data available suggests that only about 13% of all suicide attempts succeed. However, up to nearly 90% of attempts using firearms result in death. The link between gun availability and suicide has already been studied in other countries. In the early 2000s, Swiss Army reforms halved the number of soldiers, which also reduced the number of firearms kept in homes. Before the reduction, the suicide rate among 18 to 43-year-old men had already been falling, but researchers observed the rate dip sharply immediately after the reform, and then continue its gradual downward trend. Around the same time, a similar phenomenon happened in Israel, which began requiring soldiers to leave guns on base during weekend leave. After the policy change, suicide among 18 to 21-year-old soldiers fell by 40% annually. The authors of a 2010 study on the policy's consequences observed that a reduction in weekend suicides, rather than during the week, was responsible for nearly the entire drop in deaths. While relatively minor reforms, such as those in Israel and Switzerland, can have a significant impact on suicide prevention, the effects of policies on broader gun violence issues are often far more complex and difficult to assess. Morrill's team at RAND combed through the limited scientific literature on firearm policy in the U.S. to see which types of laws have the strongest evidence of reducing death and injury. Their analysis found that only child access prevention laws, such as those that require keeping guns at home safely locked, met their highest evidence-based standard for reducing injuries and deaths, and then only in children. The team found moderate evidence supporting the prohibition of gun ownership among people with mental illness or specific mental health histories. They also turned up moderate evidence that so-called stand-your-ground laws actually increased homicides. These types of laws vary by jurisdiction and can refer to a right to defend oneself, others, or property with lethal force, rather than seeking safe retreat. Morrill warns that a lack of evidence doesn't necessarily mean a given policy is ineffective. In many cases, the research either hasn't been attempted or it comes from small studies based in different states with disparate laws and other variables. For instance, there's moderate evidence that background checks, mostly those that occur at a dealership rather than private sales, reduce firearm suicides and homicides. But there's only limited evidence that they reduce overall suicide and homicide rates. It's unclear how many individuals use a different method to end their lives or someone else's if prevented from using a gun. There's also simply too little data to determine the effect of universal background checks, which would include all firearm transfers, not just those that occur at dealers. There's a whole lot of policy effects that haven't been studied, Morrill says, adding that many of the policies he and his colleagues looked at simply had no supporting research that met their standards for determining cause and effect. I really regard that as one of the big takeaways. Among the most glaring gaps in current gun violence research, the reason people buy handguns today is to defend themselves, says Morrill, and we don't know what the effects are, what the facts are around that. For example, his team found evidence-based research in support of child access prevention laws saving children's lives. But Morrill says there have not been sufficient studies on how those same laws may affect other firearm-related issues, such as whether deaths increase or decrease when a child-proof gun is involved in a legitimate act of self-defense. It's difficult to determine the full impact of such laws, positive or negative, when most of their consequences remain unknown. Another major issue, says Morrill, is that most available research is built on existing open-access databases compiled by government agencies such as the CDC. Researchers tapping into that data have no say over what information is collected or how. Instead of being able to design rigorous, controlled studies, they typically have to dig through someone else's raw data, hoping to find correlations. Ambitious projects that cost money have been very, very difficult to do for the last 20 years, Morrill says. There have been exceptions. In January, the American Journal of Public Health published a study on gun violence in some of Philadelphia's high-crime neighborhoods. Researchers divided more than 100 geographic clusters of vacant, blighted lots into three randomly selected groups. Within each group, the vacant land received either light intervention, like trash was collected and grass mowed, significant intervention, the lots were transformed into park-like settings with trees and new grass, or no intervention. The experiment lasted nearly 2 years, and researchers found a significant reduction in gun violence in the geographic clusters with vacant land that had been improved in any way. What's more, there was no evidence that shooting incidents moved from those improved clusters to adjacent areas. Another study underway in California will measure what happens when current firearm owners are later prohibited from possessing a firearm after, for example, committing a crime or receiving a specific health diagnosis. Researchers will be able to track outcomes in randomly assigned jurisdictions that give owners different amounts of time to surrender their guns. These are the sorts of studies that Morrill says have significant potential to help us better understand gun violence in America. It's a sentiment that Jay Dickey, who died in 2017, might have shared. As he neared the end of his life, Dickey advocated, with increasing vehemence, for a return to the very sort of research his 1996 amendment had halted. As he wrote in 2012, comparing gun research to the proverbial question about when to plant a tree, "The best time to start was 20 years ago. The second best time is now." Getting naked. Our human ancestors lost the primate pelt. Researchers investigate what they gained. In a lineup of primates, humans are easy to spot. We're the naked ones. While all our living evolutionary cousins sport fur coats, Homo sapiens alone are naturally nude, aside from diminutive body hairs and dense tufts over our heads, underarms, and genitals. This has vexed scientists since Charles Darwin. In his 1871, The Descent of Man, Darwin asserted that fur loss is an inconvenience and probably an injury to man. dismissing the possibility that nakedness evolved via natural selection as a trait that improved survival. He attributed it to sexual selection, a trait fancied by mates. By this view, ancestors with less body hair were more attractive and reproductively fruitful. Today, most scholars lean the other way. They contend fur loss was not for sex, but survival, specifically survival of the sweatiest. Reduced body hair enhanced the cooling capacity of sweat, a crucial adaptation in our ancestors' hot, savanna-like environments. Humans can dump heat, whereas other animals, when you chase them, overheat, says Harvard University evolutionary biologist Daniel Lieberman. Homo sapiens also stand out as the most perspiring primate. On a hot day, an average Joe can sweat 12 liters. Maximum rates for humans are over 4 times that of chimpanzees. The disparity is partially explained by relative abundances of 2 types of sweat glands: eccrine, the source of watery sweat exuded through pores, and apocrine, which secrete viscous liquid from within hair roots. Chimp skin comprises roughly 2 eccrine per 1 apocrine, but ours is almost all eccrine. Humans have just gone wild with those glands, says Lieberman. Sweat cools the body through evaporation, drawing heat away from the skin. Thick fur impedes this process. Bare skin promotes it. Researchers think fur loss coincided with eccrine gland gain in our evolutionary history as paired adaptations for better sweating. But the details on when and how are still patchy. Lieberman has proposed 2 scenarios for when and why fur was sacrificed for sweat. Both assume the changes occurred after hominins, the evolutionary branch of apes leading to humans, began walking upright and traded tropical forests for open, sunnier habitats some 7 million years ago. Fur usually shields mammals from damaging solar radiation, but bipeds could forego this protection because only their scalps are exposed to direct rays. And this likely explains why hominins kept hair on their heads. The first scenario places fur loss within a few million years of the origins of bipedalism, when our ancestors were merely 3 to 4 feet tall, with chimpanzee-sized brains. Since 2 legs are slower than 4, we have become easy pickings for any carnivore, says Lieberman. But if they were efficient at reducing heat through sweating, these small 2-legged hominins would have stayed safe by foraging during midday heat when most carnivores rest. Alternately, perspiration-prone skin may have been advantageous later in our origin story when hominins became hunters. Lieberman hypothesizes that roughly 2 million years ago, Homo erectus pursued prey by trekking and endurance running through the hottest hours of the day. The animals would eventually overheat, allowing sweaty hominins to nab their meal. The scenarios are plausible but impossible to test with fossils, the traditional source of evidence for understanding human evolution. No early hominin skin or hair has survived the ages. So Lieberman and other Harvard scientists launched a project to find the cause of human fur loss in our genes. Geneticists have the technology to see how evolutionary change happened at a basic biological level. In this case, how minor alterations to the DNA code shared by all primates could lead to uniquely human sweat and skin. However, finding these genetic variations wasn't easy, says Yana Kemberov, who joined the research team while at Harvard and now leads it at the University of Pennsylvania. We had no idea where to look for the genome. We don't know what to look for, she says. The researchers began by comparing DNA from mouse breeds that grow differing amounts of hair on their paws. Previous research has suggested that some genes may play a role in both hair and sweat gland development. The team found that less hairy mice also had more eccrine glands, and that the gene EN1 appeared to be responsible for increasing sweat gland development while reducing hair production. The discovery pointed to a potential genetic link between fur loss and sweat gland gain in mammals. The team also compared human and primate skin by counting follicles and glands in biopsies from cadavers. The resulting 2018 Journal of Human Evolution paper showed Homo sapiens have 10 times more eccrine glands than chimpanzees, but similar hair follicle density. The reason we seem to have less hair, most human follicles develop what's known as vellus hair, the fine, barely visible type, rather than terminal hair, the thick, pigmented strands found on our scalps and on the bodies of most other primates. Building on the earlier work with mice, Kemberov is narrowing in on specific genetic variants that could explain the hair and sweat gland differences between chimps and humans. Her team is now genetically engineering mice with those variants to see if they develop chimp-like or human-like skin traits. We're really at the cusp of knowing the answer, says Kimbaroff. As scientists inch closer to explaining how we lost our fur, another mystery looms. What about hair that sprouts at puberty? Why do ample patches cover underarms, genitals, and faces to varying degrees depending on age, sex, and heredity? Some researchers see this hair as an evolutionary accident, perhaps a side effect of hormone activity. The transformation happens because sex hormones, including testosterone, cause follicles to switch from vellus to terminal hair. But many scholars think post-pubescent hair is a product of sexual selection. It seems Darwin's early notions of nakedness better explains the presence of some hair, rather than its general absence. It's possible that hair that develops at puberty may have attracted members of the opposite sex by signaling that an individual was mature enough to reproduce. Alternatively, body hair could have advertised status or strength, such as a form of intimidation between males competing for females. Over the last 50 years, researchers have tried to evaluate these hypotheses by testing people's gut reactions to body hair. Barnaby Dixon, an anthropologist at the University of Queensland, Australia, has conducted more than a dozen such studies, several focusing on beards, which he considers the most obvious social marker of sexual maturity and biological maleness in our species. The results are consistent in one respect. Universally, bearded men are judged as older, more masculine, and aggressive. But do females consider that look attractive? That depends on their culture, economic conditions, relationship status, and life stage. Present-day social influences and life experiences may override innate dispositions. And while most researchers have focused on visual signals sent by body hair, it's also been suggested that the message is sent via scent. Remember those apocrine glands that release oily secretions? Of the small number of humans that humans do have, most are found associated with armpit and pubic hairs. Regardless of the ancestral function of body hair, today it doesn't have to be what it evolved to be. Culture can make it beyond what nature had intended for it, says Christopher Oldstone Moore, a historian at Wright State University in Dayton, Ohio. His 2015 book, Of Beards and Men, showed this to be true for facial hair. The work chronicled styles across Western civilization for millennia, from ancient Mesopotamia to today. According to Oldstone Moore, facial hair trends reflect shifting attitudes about manliness. Shaving is associated with discipline and control, conformity to established norms, he says. When clean shaves were in vogue, men derived status from social approval. During beard times, manliness was about natural physical strength. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slotkey, reading for the Triangle for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. Again, that's area code 919-832-5138.